Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Maude Levin will talk about pop culture's new enthusiasm for aggressive women. Also, MTV gets real about abortion, but Naomi Wolf gets surreal and victim-blaming about rape. I'm going to cover this issue in more detail later in the podcast, but I was on Blogging Heads to discuss the Julian Assange rape allegations, and here's a clip from the hour-long discussion.
I think half the reason people don't call it rape a lot of the time is because once you label yourself a rape victim, like, that stain don't wash out, like... I mean, everyone looks at you differently once they realize you're a rape victim. Normalize the idea and get over it. But if they have never confronted or dealt with the fact that that somebody can be a rape victim and perfectly fine and normal, like, then they just sort of get like, oh, like.
The focus of the discussion was what we should mean when we call something rape. And unsurprisingly, I'm of the opinion that all non-consenting sex should be called rape. MTV has had, for years now, a reality TV series called 16 and Pregnant. I've never watched it since I'm really not that big on reality TV, but I have heard feminists who do watch it criticize the show for only showing teenagers who have babies and not those that have abortions. Well, to their eternal credit, MTV responded by having a special episode where they followed three young women who chose abortion. I'm not particularly upset that they only did this as a special. There's not much story to a pregnancy after an abortion. Following someone who actually has a baby gives you enough material for an entire series. I'm just glad they noted that there are other options. They did a good job of portraying how abortion actually happens in the real world with their three teenage subjects. First, you had a young woman who, like 60% of women who have abortions, is already a mother.
Like getting another one, that's more money, that's more, and we already putting on school and stuff like that.
Like, I know it's gonna be hard. And like, I talked to another good friend of mine, she's like, what about adoption? That's not an option for me. If I feel that baby kick inside of me, off rip, I'm in love. I'm in love with this baby already, and this baby not doing nothing but making me sick.
Yeah.
So now I started thinking, like, I'm leaning towards really having an abortion.
Basically, her reasoning is one that's very common amongst women who have abortions, which is she's not doing it so much for herself, but for her already existing child. Not that there's anything wrong with choosing for yourself, but it's interesting how women who have abortions are presented as selfish, when in fact they're often only thinking about other people, particularly their children. The whole first segment, where we follow Marque and her partner James through the decision and the procedure, is touching, particularly when he carries her up the stairs after the abortion so she can get some rest. We see abortion as it's rarely portrayed, as a decision that is worked over with family and friends, and where women who get it are struggling to balance all their desires and needs in life and have come to this decision. What was really great was that the information provided was accurate and compassionate, even though the usually callous Dr. Drew was the host of the program.
Having an abortion is not uncommon, but talking about it publicly really is. 1 in 3 of all women in the U.S. will have an abortion in their lifetime. Think about that. So although each circumstance is different, Marque is far from alone. It's important to know that after an abortion, there can be a range of different emotions from sadness and loss to even happiness and relief.
They brought two more young women in who had the choice to have abortions to discuss what they went through and why they went with abortion. For people who have vicious stereotypes of women who have abortions as dumb sluts, this program and the work they did in showing women as complex individuals was probably what you'd call quite unwelcome. They interviewed one young woman who had to deal with parental notification laws.
I understand that you were one of the 35 states that require parental involvement.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have your parents' consent?
No. I went to court and I got a judicial bypass. So I stood in front of a judge and asked them to please not make me tell my parents. and they granted it, but it's kind of hard to stand in front of a stranger in an empty courtroom all by yourself with no one standing next to you.
At 17?
At 17, begging for permission to make your own decision.
One of my biggest concerns with having Dr. Drew heading this up is that he'd get all judgmental about contraception. A lot of people who are nominally pro-choice still buy into the stupid slut stereotype and think women who have abortions are simply lackadaisical about contraception. That's what people are saying when they say that they don't think abortion should be used as birth control. The reality is more complicated. Some women don't use contraception because it's hard to get, or they don't have a supportive partner, or they may even be with an abusive partner. But two of the panelists were making an effort towards contraception and failed because they didn't receive proper education about how birth control actually works. The first young woman didn't realize you can't be late with depo shots. And then you have this.
How'd you react? What'd you do? What'd you think?
I was incredibly angry because I had thought I was protecting myself.
What happened?
I was taking birth control, but I wasn't taking it effectively, I guess. I was getting sick from it, and I didn't realize that if you're throwing up the pill, it's not in your system.
But didn't anybody encourage you to contact them if you were having any kind of side effects?
No, I had never been told, and I didn't really know what
right,
to do
so I have just an aside for everybody out there. Everyone should be able to find a contraceptive that is effective for them, that they understand what the potential side effects are, and what the risks are associated with it. So I would urge you again to go to www.itsyoursexlife.com.
It's easy to judge if you don't look at your own life. But who among us can say we know exactly how every medication that a doctor has given us works? Seriously, most people can't even tell which medication is a painkiller and which is an antibiotic. So why do we expect women to just know how hormonal birth control works without extensive education? They even touched upon the financial hardship of abortion.
He was very supportive, and he helped pay for it. It was $750 for the procedure.
How did you come up with that?
My ex-boyfriend at the time had just started his first job, and he put a lot of money towards it. I also had to make sacrifices. I had to sell my prom ticket back to my high school to get that, you know, whatever, $80 or $90 back. I had to make sacrifices.
There's so much more, but luckily you can watch it online with the link provided in the show notes. Exhale has partnered with MTV to show support for these women, knowing that they're going to get a lot of grief for coming out. You can join the campaign at 16andloved.com. I'd like to welcome Maud Lavin to the program. Maud is a professor of visual and critical studies in art history, theory, and criticism at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She's also the author of a few books, and she's here today to talk about her latest, Push Comes to Shove, New Images of Aggressive Women. Welcome to RealityCast, Maud.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book is about a massive cultural shift in how pop culture and art, of course, views aggression in women. What did it used to be like, and what is it like now?
Well, like you said, there's been a shift since the 90s and continuing to the present day. And it's just amazing how mass culture, in particular, different producers used to always depict if there was an aggressive woman, she would get punished, you know, like in the movies. Thelma and Louise is a great example. But in general, it was just very frowned on. And now, although there's still a lot of that in women's daily lives, at least mass culture has done a big turn. And there's all the Biff Bam Pow stuff, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, Buffy, you name it, Nikita, Maggie Q and Nikita, and so forth. So, yeah, it's a big shift. And for the book, I was wondering, well, what is going on here? What could we add to it? And what does it have to do with daily life and so on?
And why do you think there's a sudden fascination with images of aggressive women in pop culture?
Well, I don't think there's just one answer. It's as usual, there's this accumulation of factors. One thing is the passage of Title IX and the generational shift that caused in terms of women playing sports, girls playing sports, not having to be self-identified as a jock to do so, but everybody doing that. That's That's a big shift in the United States. Then we had the mainstreaming of Riot Girls and some of the other things that we inherited from punk and from also some of the women doing hip-hop. And that mainstreamed in the 90s, girl power, Spice Girls, etc. I think that there's a desire on the part of female mass culture consumers to open up a range of emotions, including aggression, because more women in many different countries are in the workplace. And so the demure stereotypes just don't fit at all. So that's another factor. And then I think less easy to see, but very always there omnipresently, is the internet and the more rapid and circular exchanges of cultural images starting in the 90s, so that trends could switch even faster and take on huge proportions even faster.
So what are some of your favorite examples of this new, these new images of aggressive women?
Well, I really looked a lot at very mainstream culture, because that fascinated me, that even right in the core that things were changing. And so, yeah, one of the first things I did was to look at this wave of women in sports, girls in sports movies that have come out of Hollywood since in the last about 15, 20 years, and like Bring It On and Stick It and Blue Crush, and not surprisingly, some of the writers and directors of those films are themselves women who were Title IX babies, so to speak, like Jess Bendinger, who wrote Bring It On and wrote and directed Stick It.
Do you think ordinary women are feeling empowered by all this media, between the sports movies and things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and other things like that? Do you think ordinary women are feeling empowered by it, or is it relegated to the world of fantasy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that is the question, right? And I think that it's our relationships, plural, between fantasy and what cultural images, and then our actual day-to-day lives are very, very complicated. So I don't think that one simply consumes an image and then is immediately fueled by it. But I do think that what's going on is really important, because what's been happening is the coining of a new set of stereotypes. And when you look at it cumulatively, when you look at it, there's so much of this now that in some ways it's no big deal. I think the mundane quality of it is super important. And I don't know if that's empowering, but it does clear some prohibitions out. So, for example, if I need to go in and argue for a raise, and I've just seen a million, to exaggerate, of these images, you know, being forceful is just not going to seem as shocking to me as it might have if this whole set of stereotypes, new stereotypes, didn't exist. So I think it's the normalization of it and the accumulation of these images that might make a difference should one decide to use them.
Of course, you know, there's a huge difference between having the courage to ask for a raise and actually dealing with violence, which is something that a lot of these images show women being violent or pushing back against violence. And how do you feel real-life women feel about those images and in any relationship that they might have with real-life violence?
I always like to describe this book as progression but anti-violence. So actually there's only one chapter that deals with images of women being violent, and there's much, much more discussion about forcefulness beyond assertiveness. So I have a broad definition of aggression as forcefulness, and it's a lot about the depiction of women being forceful and not violent. So on the other hand, this does, a lot of the discussion in the book does apply to at least the warding off of potential violence, because I'm, of course, very much in agreement with psychologists like Dana Crowley-Jack that who argue that individuals need aggression in order to establish boundaries, in order to say no, in order to leave situations that are potentially dangerous. I mean, that does require calling on some inner aggression. So in that sense, this proactive aggressive stance, nonviolent, though. It doesn't have to be physical. Aggression does not have to be physical. In fact, usually it's verbal. I mean, for that women in the way that women have are newly acculturated to use it. I'm not that interested in women committing violence, and although that there's been some rise in women committing violent crimes, generally speaking, to be extremely general, in the population as a whole, women are on average smaller than men, and so I don't. You know, I don't really see a desirable or successful deployment of aggression on women's part as being physical. I mean, it just doesn't. It's against my ethics, but it also just doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do like in the whole book. There's an emphasis away from depicting women as victims, and I think it's very important to have a lot of depictions of women not in a victim stance. I think that's a stereotype that we do not want to normalize.
You see a lot of women on television that are in the assertive position that you're talking about. So you like turn on a show like Grey's Anatomy or any show that shows women in the professional workplace, and they're often hyper-competent, super straightforward, highly mm-hmm. professional. Mm-hmm. Do you think that these images, they're good in the way that you said, do you think that they have any downsides to them?
Sure, yes. Well, our mass culture, U.S. mass culture, and in the first world in general, it's a consumer culture, and it's about selling. And so a lot of the images are, for example, of young women with perfect bodies. And, you know, those can be oppressive, as has been well documented, if that pressure towards perfection. And I tried to consider also aging and aggression in the book. And I went back to Helen Mirren, of course, in Prime Suspect, and not only is she older, so that's important, but her character is flawed, and she is forceful and gets the job done and so forth, but also sometimes her aggression just boils over, and she can be very clumsy socially and so forth. So I'm interested in those kinds of characterizations of the imperfect woman. Yet, you know, who does get to win at the end, because I think we've had too few of those.
Helen Mirren is making something of a later life career of being the aggressive woman. She's in that movie, what is it called, Red?
Mm-hmm. Just say, Helen Mirren has three movies coming out this fall. One of them, Red, is already out. And Helen Mirren in real life is in her mid-60s and plays women on the screen who are approximately that age too, with some flashbacks thrown in, and her roles are actually getting more. She's very aggressive, and maybe more so than in most of her earlier ones. Although, what I find interesting is when she starts studying Helen Mirren's use of aggression, you see that in a lot of her roles throughout her life, she fuses lust and aggression, and keeps those both very much to the fore in her characters, even in a repressed one like the Queen. She's very stubborn and so forth. So I think that's part of Mirren's signature, is to flavor her her characterizations with aggression.
So I have time for one more question, and I want your opinion on this. Online debates amongst Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans. I've gone many rounds with people who feel like Sarah Michelle Gellar, who is very slight of build and very tiny, was inappropriate for that role. And I actually kind of always liked it because I felt like it showed that you can still be very feminine and traditionally feminine and still aggressive. Where do you fall on that, or what are your feelings on that?
I love Buffy, and I think that Allison Hannigan is one of the most interesting characters on it. For one thing, she gets the best lines. She's the smart girl. She's verbal, and the writing is terrific on the whole with Buffy, so she gets some really great lines. And then we have her exploring her sexuality, exploring her use of force in all kinds of ways. Sometimes she's overwhelmed by it. Other times she's exhilarated by it. She's I think, the really interesting character. And then, although she's, of course, typically thin for Hollywood and so forth, but she's not conventionally Barbie-like beauty. She's got her own style and so forth. So I think that character is probably the most compelling.
My guest today has been Maud Lavin, and her book is called Push Comes to Shove, New Images of Aggressive Women. It's out on MIT Press, and it's available from their website or from other booksellers. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Maud.
Thank you.
And now it's time for a game of Spot the Rape Myths, the game show where contestants try to cram as many falsehood and myths about rape as they can into the shortest time possible. Today's contestant is Naomi Wolf, supposed feminist now turned rape apologist for the Julian Assange case. Now, by covering Wolf's apologist behavior, let us be clear. No one is taking a stand on Assange's innocence or guilt. This is about spreading myths about rape and why it's wrong. Wolf signed up, rather unknowingly, I must say, by going on Democracy Now! To debate Jacqueline Friedman. And she was, I must say, extremely competitive in the art of spreading rape myths.
The case I've ever seen in 23 years of supporting rape victims, which is based on multiple instances of consent. If you read these allegations, he took off Miss A's clothes too quickly for her comfort. She tried to tell him to slow down, but then, quote, she allowed him to undress her.
We're checking Naomi's statements against a list of date rape myths put together by SmarterSex.org. And already Naomi has scored a point. From SmarterSex, quote, myth. When a woman agrees to make out with a man, she is implying that she will have intercourse with him too. And fact. Everyone has the right to say no to sexual activity, regardless of what has preceded it, and to have that no respected. End quote.
This is what the report says. The second woman says she woke to find him having sex with her. When she asked whether he was wearing a condom, he said no. Quote, according to her statement, she said, you better not have HIV. He answered, of course not. Quote, she couldn't be bothered to tell him one more time because she had been going on about the condom all night. She'd never had unprotected sex before.
This is in reference to the woman who, according to the report, had sex earlier with Assange when he did cave and wear a condom. From Smarter Sex, quote, myth. It's not rape if the man is her boyfriend or husband or if they had sex before. And fact. A woman has a right to decide what she does with her body at all times. If she does not want to have sex, it is her decision, even if she willingly had sex with the man before. End quote. But this is a two-pointer for Naomi because she also points out that the woman had said no multiple times before she surrendered. The implication is that you merely saying no over and over and over until you're exhausted isn't good enough. Quote, myth, women who don't physically fight back haven't been raped. And fact, if a woman did not or could not consent to having sex, it is considered rape. Forcing a woman to have sex against her will, whether she physically fights back or not, is rape, plain and simple. End quote. It is worth noting that the allegation is that he had sex with her in her sleep, when you couldn't even give consent, which she had, remember, allegedly withdrawn. repeatedly.
A kept Assange in her home for the next 4 days and threw a party for him.
Nice one, Naomi. This is actually a less common rape myth, though it is one favored by right-wing rape apologists, especially in my experience. From the University of Minnesota's Rape Myth website, we get this. Quote, myth, a person who has really been assaulted will be hysterical. And fact, survivors exhibit a spectrum of emotional responses to assault. Calm, hysteria, laughter, anger, apathy, shock. Each survivor copes with the trauma of the assault in a different way. End quote. Tracy Clark Flory interviewed Diane Moyer, legal director of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, and Moyer said, quote, it may seem counterintuitive, but it is not unusual for a victim to want to normalize the situation. Essentially, the victim is prey to self-doubt, end quote.
In 23 years, I've never seen any man in any situation this ambiguous, involving this much consent, have any kind of legal process whatsoever. And all over the world, women who've been gang raped, brutally raped, raped in alleyways, pimped, prostituted, trafficked, you know, their rapists go free.
Naomi is getting near jazz-like in her ability to riff on common rape myths now. Myth: rape is only committed by strangers in dark alleys and parking lots. And fact, as many as 84% of women are raped by someone they know, such as friends, family, or an acquaintance. Granted, she didn't say it had to be a stranger. But she was basically implying that because some rapes are more lurid or violent than others, only the scariest ones are actually rape. And that's basically the same idea. So point for Wolf. That makes her total a solid and remarkable 5 rape myths promoted in a short 3 minutes. That's got to be a record that only Glenn Beck could probably beat. Let me close this episode with Jacqueline Friedman's explanation of why these rape myths are so dangerous.
And it's also one of the most underreported crimes across the globe. And one of the reasons is because every time the issue comes up in the media, people come out of the woodwork to blame the victims and to minimize the crime. And unfortunately, when we see someone who is a progressive hero like Assange is, those critics, those people who are doing that minimization and that victim blaming, often come from the left as well as the right. And we've seen that across the board, unfortunately, with Naomi Wolf has participated in that, as well as Michael Moore, Keith Olbermann, Glenn Beck. Of course, plenty of people on the right are participating as well. And the result of that is not only that these women are receiving death threats, they are in hiding. One of them has gone to Palestine because she couldn't feel safe in Sweden anymore. But the even more important result of that, when we perpetuate rape myths in the media, and this is not just my opinion, this has been documented by social research, is that victims, nameless victims, victims who have been harmed by people who are not famous, become much more reluctant to take their experiences seriously, to report those experiences. The system, the justice system that's supposed to work for those victims, the cops, the juries, the prosecutors, the judges, they become much more reluctant to take these allegations seriously when they are reported. And men become less likely to identify their own behaviors as sexually violent. And the result of all of that is that rapists go free.
And now for the wisdom of wingnuts, using breast cancer as a football edition. The FDA hasn't approved the drug Avastin for the treatment of breast cancer because it hasn't been shown to work well enough to justify the side effects. But on Fox and Friends, they pretended it was because of healthcare reform.
The FDA is deciding the fate of nearly 20,000 women who are battling breast cancer right now. The government is considering revoking approval of the drug Avastin for the treatment of late-stage breast cancer. But is this because of cost?
This is pretty despicable, even by right-wing lying standards. The FDA doesn't consider cost in these decisions. No matter what your crackpot ideology, you shouldn't want people to be taking drugs that don't work and make them sicker just because the drugs are for sale.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.